You're listening to History Out Loud, Chat from the Stacks, a podcast by Calderdale Libraries. Presented by Jill Carpenter. So welcome back, listeners, to History Out Loud. Today, I'm joined by regular guest, Paul Weatherhead. Welcome, Paul.
Hello, nice to be here.
Yeah, nice to be back. I say regular, but I mean, it has been a while, I think, since you last recorded with us. I think it was Robin Hood, wasn't it?
That's right. It was a Robin Hood two-parter. Yes.
Well, for anybody listening who hasn't had the pleasure of listening to any of the episodes we've done with Paul, I'll just say a little bit. He's a native of the Calder Valley. He was brought up in Hebden Bridge. Currently, he teaches research and academic skills to international students in Manchester. But he's also a musician and a songwriter and an author. His book, Weird Calderdale, was first published in 2003, but he managed an expanded edition during the COVID lockdowns, and that was published in 2021. Is that right?
Yes, that's right.
It's interesting, really, because when I was chatting with Jill Liddington, that was when she wrote her book, was during lockdown as well. So it was quite fruitful for some people, I guess.
Certainly was. And I guess it's the idea, you know, with other social events being cancelled and no gigs taking place.
Yeah.
It was an opportunity to focus the mind on something. Yeah.
Well, I'm really pleased to have you back. And the topic we're going to talk about today, the title of the chapter in Paul's book is Tom Bell, the Exploding Outlaw of Hebden Bridge, which brings all sorts of images to mind. So who was Tom Bell? He's not a real person, is he? He's folklore.
He's a figure from local folklore. Yeah, that's right. Tom Bell was an outlaw. He lived in a network of caves around Hardcastle Crags. And he's described as being very, you know, a savage. He was very shaggy, as you'd expect from someone who lived in a cave. But also in the folklore, and surprisingly for a thief, he wore clanking iron. He always carried a spear or a sword. And by night, he'd plunder the local farms and steal the livestock and fill his cave with cured meat that he'd stolen. And he'd also plunder the local churches for their valuables. And one of the things he did to avoid being caught was wear his boots back to front so that anyone who tried following him would get lost. And so by night, he was a thief. By day, he would sit in his cave and gorge himself on the meat that he'd stolen, along with his only companions, which were the rats, bats, the vermin of the cave. And that's who Tom Bell was.
It's an interesting character. He met quite a grisly end, didn't he? What's the story behind what happened to him?
The story of the end of Tom Bell goes that one night, he did have one friend, by the way, as well as the rats and the crows and everything. He had a human friend called Willie the Woodcutter. And one night, Willie the Woodcutter was dragging a stolen lamb towards Tom Bell's cave to share a feast together. And two little children happened to witness this, who were playing in the woods in Hardcastle Crags. And they'd often wondered where Willie the Woodcutter was going at strange hours. So they vowed that the following day they'd go and investigate the cave themselves. Anyway, as Willie the Woodcutter came towards Tom Bell's cave, he saw two crows shoot past him out of the cave, and they were carrying something horrible and bloody in their beaks. And as he went further into Tom Bell's cave, Willie the Woodcutter was met with such a horrific sight that he dropped the lamb and fled screaming into the night, and the lamb bounded after him. So what was it that Willie the Woodcutter had seen that was so horrific that sent him running screaming into Hardcastle Crags? Well, we find out the next day when the children returned to the cave to investigate. And the children sort of skip through Hardcastle Crags and then come to the cave. And as they go inside, they see the same sight that had terrified Willie the Woodcutter the previous night. And there they saw Tom Bell, whose eyes had been pecked out by the crows, presumably, and his empty sockets were staring at the dying embers of a fire. He was holding his sword in his hand, which was black with blood. But worst of all, his insides were dripping down the cave wall. and the rats and the bats and the crows that were his friends were feasting on him. And the whole image was sort of lit by the eerie green phosphorescence of a rotten root. So it turns out that Tom Bell, being a glutton, had eaten so much that he burst, he'd exploded. And so the two children, traumatized, obviously crept out of the cave, whispering, "Willie's dead." And they say that Tom Bell's treasure is still there, hidden in the cave, waiting to be found by one brave explorer one day.
Yeah, certainly is a grisly end, isn't it? Gosh, it kind of brings to mind Monty Python to me. I don't know.
It brings to mind Mr. Creosote, yeah. Doesn't it? And one wafer thin mint. I suppose one strange thing about it that doesn't seem to make sense, and maybe it will do when we look more at the sources, is that the children who found him, they knew who Willie the Woodcutter was. Yet when they saw Tom Bell, they assumed that the body they saw was Willie the Woodcutter, when they would obviously know Willie the Woodcutter. So that's something that clunks a little bit in the traditional telling of the tale.
Right. So what you've just described is the traditional folklore that has been passed down.
Yeah, it's a sort of a composite tale, really, from some of the sources, the poems and the pamphlets.
Yeah. So yeah, that's quite a good place to come on to the actual evidence for this tale. There are a couple of ballad poems, aren't they, that were written?
Yeah, the first one, the first real reference that we have to Tom Bell is from an 1840 poem by William Broadbent, and it's called "A Rural Walk on a Summer's Day in the Groves of Hebden in Company with Mary and Martha."
That's quite a title.
It certainly is a title. It's almost as long as the poem. he describes a nice walk through Hardcastle Crags, and he tells us about Tom Bell's cave and the legend. So that was published in 1840 posthumously, and that's the first reference we get to Tom Bell. And he describes the tale as being a true traditionary tale, well known to dwellers in the Vale, suggesting that people in Hebden already knew about the story of Tom Bell. So we get quite a lot of the detail about Tom Bell in this poem, about the way he appears, his clanking chains, his shaggy appearance, and his gluttony and his criminal exploits. What we don't get, though, is Tom Bell's explosive end. In the Broadbent poem, he just says, "How long he lived or where he died, lo, nothing more is said beside."
Oh, right. That's interesting.
That's interesting because the explosive end is such an integral and sort of shocking part of the tale that it's strange to see that in the earliest version of the legend, it's not even present.
Right. So the second poem, William Dearden's poem, how did that go?
Well, William Dearden's poem is called "A Vale of Caldeen," and that was published in 1844. And this is a real monster of a poem. It's six books long. So this is a proper old-fashioned romantic poem. And the poem concerns the author, who he refers to as the Pilgrim, returning to the Hebden Valley after some time absent, and it describes all the poverty and deprivation that he witnesses. And the bit that sort of concerns Tom Bell's cave happens in book six. Strangely enough, though, Tom Bell isn't mentioned. He talks about a robber's cave, but the main character in book six is actually Willie the Woodcutter. And the poem tells a story of how Willie the Woodcutter, who's unemployed, destitute, and his wife and child are starving, and he's wandering the moors in despair, when he's confronted by this skeletal demon, and the demon gives him a horrific vision of his wife and child starving to death. And so this turns poor Willie into a raving maniac, and he wanders the moors gnashing his teeth, and he tells this demon to take him to a quiet place, a secluded place where he can take his own life. And so the demon leads him to something known as the Robber's Cave, which is Tom Bell's cave. Turns out, though, that the demon has misled Willie the Woodcutter, and in fact, his wife and child have secured some kind of income, and they've got a supply of bread and cakes, and his child's sleeping peacefully with a full belly in his bed. So the next thing that we know about poor Willie happens when a starving man drags a stolen lamb towards the robber's cave, the cave where the demon led Willy the Woodcutter. So already we've got a kind of confusion in the legend. In the original legend, we've got Tom Bell in the cave and Willy the Woodcutter dragging the lamb. In the poem, we've got Willy the Woodcutter in the cave and an unnamed starving man dragging the stolen lamb towards the cave. And as he drags the lamb towards the cave, he sees the crows rush out with the bloody beaks again. He goes in, he sees the corpse lit by the same glowing root. And of course, the sword is black with blood, but it turns out that Willy the Woodcutter has cut his own throat. And we're just told that poor old Willy is buried like a dog. So we've got a very different origin story there, where in the original, we've got Tom Bell, the glutton, who's almost punished for his gluttony. And that's compared with poor old Willy in the poem, who's haunted by starvation and madness and hallucinations.
Yeah, there's kind of key things, aren't there? There's like the lamb, there's the crows, there's the cave, and food. So when I read both versions of the story, I thought they take two different stances, don't they? One's about gluttony, what happens when you eat too much, and the other's about starvation. And I was just wondering, you know, at the time, historically, would there be factors that would be influencing that, you know, like, say, shortage of food? Or
I think it would always be on people's mind. I mean, it would have been a hard life in the valley at that time, and if you've fallen on hard times, it'd be very difficult to get out of that. And I think that was what Dearden was describing in his long and very grim poem.
Yeah, he goes into full gothic mode.
He does, yeah. I suppose it is from the sort of the era of gothic fiction, pretty much.
It's a little bit Dickensian, isn't it? Being met by a spirit who shows you an image.
It is, isn't it? There's a bit of a Christmas Carol there, except a much darker version of a Christmas Carol.
And with the gluttony, it almost seems as well, with the involvement of the children, it's almost like a fable. A lot of the fairy tales from the past, actually, when you go back to the roots, it's almost like they're there to frighten children into not doing something. So it's like, this is what happens when you eat too much, your stomach bursts and that's it. I don't know if there's anything of that element in it.
I think there is. I think it is that Tom Bell is a bit of a bogeyman and used to scare children. And although perhaps we don't get it in the Dearden poem so much because we don't really have the children, but I think the idea of the children losing their innocence in such a horrible way, I think it is part of it. It is a very grim kind of fairy tale.
So after the poems, there were a couple of pamphlets, weren't there, that people had written. Were these at the time considered historical documents, or were they more stories for entertainment?
There were more stories for entertainment. They're the kind of things that a tourist might pick up at a cafe, at the cafe in Hardcastle Crags. So I think that's what they were designed for. The first one is called Stories from Hardcastle Crags and Heptonstall, number one. I don't know if there was ever a number two. I haven't been able to find it. But that was published in 1919. And that gives a summary of the Tom Bell legend as I've told it. And it seems to mix elements of the Broadbent poem and elements of the Dearden poem, in which Willy the Woodcutter becomes like a sidekick. And but the death of Tom Bell is described that he burnt and went off with a quack. He burnt himself and went off with a quack is the exact words of the pamphlet. So not entirely clear what that means.
Spontaneous combustion.
I wondered if it was spontaneous combustion. He fell asleep near the fire or whatever, caught fire and exploded. I wondered whether it might be, you know, his meaty diet, an enclosed space and a naked flame. You know, was it an attack of deadly wind that got him? But that seems, but we've got the element of, it says he burnt himself and went off with a quack. So, but no other detail about what happened to him. By the time we get to the following pamphlet, which is called Stories of Folklore from the District Known as Hardcastle Crags, I'm not sure when that's published. There's no date on it, but it seems to be shortly after the first pamphlet. And that, again, has another summary of the story, but there it's much clearer and just says that he burst. So that's where we get, you know, the clear picture that Tom Bell ate so much that he burst.
Yeah. So in your book, you mentioned that it's interesting the two words burst and burn are quite similar.
Yeah, I just wondered whether it may be that the author of the second pamphlet had looked at the first one and rehashed it, but maybe just missed one word or misspelled one word or misremembered one word, and that had sort of gone from burnt to burst. So, I mean, it does seem to me that one or both writers of the two Hardcastle Crag pamphlets were half remembering elements of Broadbent's poem that describes who Tom Bell was and what he did, and then half remembering bits of William Dearden's poem about Willie the Woodcutter and the Robber's Cave, and then sort of mixing them together into a kind of strange stew that incorporates elements of both.
Yeah, that's a good way of putting it, a strange stew, isn't it? Because you've got the Broadbent poem, which claims to not really know what happens to him at all, and then you've got Dearden poem, where it's kind of like turned into Willie the Woodcutter, and he meets a grisly end. And then you've got the two pamphlets. It is a stew.
It is.
So all this is taking place at the beginning of the 20th century.
That's right, yeah.
But the story doesn't end there, does it? It doesn't end with the end of Tom Bell in the cave.
The story, like Tom Bell's cave, is labyrinthine with various passages leading off from it. Yeah, that's true.
So the pamphlets were published at the beginning of the 20th century, but if we take a little step back, and this is after the poem, we're going into actual real life now, we're not in folklore. There was something that happened in 1894, wasn't there, that started off more interest in Tom Bell. What was that?
Well, in 1894, remains of a boar's skull were found in Tom Bell's cave. And
is this in Hardcastle Crags?
This is in Hardcastle Crags. And that led to some speculation, you know, maybe that was the remains of his last meal. But I think the real controversy happened in 1899, a few years later. And that's when the whole town of Hebden Bridge erupted into a kind of Tom Bell fever. And Tom Bell became a kind of strange tourist attraction, bringing treasure hunters and explorers into Hebden Bridge looking for, and to Hardcastle Crags looking for his lost treasure.
Yeah. So there's a chap called Herbert Cooper, isn't there? He's quite a key character in this. Son-in-law of Mr. Thomas, the owner of the estate that included the cave. And he claimed to have discovered the skull of Tom Bell, didn't he? What do we know about Herbert Cooper?
Well, Herbert Cooper was involved with a cafe that was very near to where Tom Bell's cave is supposed to be situated. And he describes how in 1899 he explored the cave. And perhaps I can read a bit from his description to the Hebden Bridge Times in 1899. So he describes going into the cave and exploring it, and he says, "There's a place a bit further in where for a distance of 7 yards you have to crawl through like a snail. There's only just room for your body, and I had to pull myself through by slow degrees, pushing my candle on in front of me a few inches at a time. At the end of the passage, I one day found the skull. I was horrified."
Yeah.
And he was so horrified that he had to inch out backwards, dragging the candle after him. And he returned later with a hook and pulled out the skull. He was too scared to touch it. And he described that on his way out that second time, he got lost, and he was lost for 2 hours in the cave. And that ever since he had nightmares, and he vowed never to return. But he was convinced that he'd found the skull of Tom Bell the Outlaw. So what he's saying is that Tom Bell is no longer a figure of folklore. He's a figure of fact, and he had Tom Bell's skull to prove it.
Right. We should probably just sort of say at this point as well that Hardcastle Crags in those days, it was a bit of a tourist spot, wasn't it?
Mm.
People used to come from all over. It was a bit different to how it is today. I know people come to walk their dogs today, but and then you've got Gibson Mill.
Yeah, it attracted lots of visitors. I mean, it was easy to get to from the conurbations, like, you know, Bradford and Halifax and Manchester and whatever. And so people would come to explore the crags and the valleys. Yeah.
So how was Herbert Cooper's discovery received by the people of Hebden Bridge? What did they say? He turns up in town with his skull. This is the skull of Tom Bell. What do they say?
Well, it was greeted with quite a lot of scepticism, and it led to a kind of light-hearted civil war in the town, with the town being divided into the cavists and the anti-cavists. And so the cavists were the ones who said that Tom Bell's skull was real and it wasn't a hoax, and the anti-cavists argued that the skull was a hoax, presumably carried out by Herbert Cooper to draw more business to his cafe. But the cave became more and more popular with tourists, and various search parties came looking for his treasure. We've got a description of the skull, actually. It's described as having large, bony, protuberant eye sockets, a retreating forehead, a prominent lower jaw, and described as being of low development, which seems to sound like Tom Bell.
Yeah.
But anyway, the town was split into cavists and anti-cavists, and there was a letter war in the local papers.
They liked doing that sort of thing then, didn't they, letter wars?
Mm.
So the cavists, we've got a chief character who represented them, Mr. Abraham Foster Barrett, a hypnotist, magnetic healer, and rather worryingly also a science teacher.
An interesting character, yeah. Unfortunately, I wish I knew more about him. But yeah, so the anti-cavists were led by John Clay, who'd written a number of sceptical letters to the local press. And it was Clay and Barrett that formed the nucleus of the great debate that occurred in January 1900.
So this was set up by the Education Committee of Mythamroyd Cooperative Society, wasn't it?
That's right, yeah. They organised a great debate to settle the matter of Tom Bell's skull between the cavists and the anti-cavists. And there was a packed audience came to watch the debate. The skull was produced as evidence. And John Clay, for the anti-cavists, said that he'd explored the caves on numerous occasions with great care, and that he'd never seen a skull there and found no evidence of any humans ever living there. But to counter this, Abraham Barrett said that John Clay had actually been exploring the wrong cave, and that's why he hadn't seen the skull. And this will become a recurring theme over the years, that it's never really clear which particular cave they're talking about. And there's always the accusation that the reason you didn't find anything is because you were exploring the wrong cave. And that's something we'll come back to numerous times. But anyway, those were the main arguments of the cavists and the anti-cavists. The audience loved it. They collapsed in gales of laughter a number of times. On one occasion, someone said that mummified cats had been found in the cave, and someone else replied that those cats had actually been found by Herbert Cooper's brother-in-law in a malt tub in Cliviger, and that was greeted with great laughter. But in the end, the debate solved nothing.
Wasn't there something about Herbert Cooper? His father-in-law was a former sexton and may have had access to human bones. Was that raised as well?
It was. And when we get to the two pamphlets, Hardcastle Crags pamphlets that we discussed, they generally come to the conclusion that Tom Bell's skull was a hoax. And the sort of circumstantial evidence against Herbert Cooper is that, firstly, he worked in the cafe along with his father-in-law that was going to benefit from the increased tourist trade to Hardcastle Crags. And as you say, his father-in-law was a former gravedigger, and so he had access to skulls. Interestingly, there's another possibility, is that the skull was a hoax, but Herbert Cooper was the victim of the hoax rather than the perpetrator, because Russell Dean, a local businessman, claims that his grandfather actually placed the skull in the cave ready to be found by Herbert Cooper. So there's another twist to the story.
There's also the idea that perhaps the thought of it being Tom Bell is the least interesting aspect of it. It could well be like a very ancient artifact that's been found. Well, not artifact, a skull. It got passed around a little bit, didn't it? Nobody knows where it is now, but it got passed around. Various people examined it, and there was some ideas that it might be Neolithic.
That's right. Yeah, it got passed around. The last we know of it, it seems to have gone to William Boyd Dawkins of Manchester University, and he concluded that it was prehistoric, possibly Neolithic. There's also suggestions that it was a female skull rather than a male skull, but it seems to have disappeared, and it hasn't been seen since the very early days of the 20th century. So yeah, it would be interesting to find the skull and see what modern technology makes of it. I mean, there is a photograph of it owned by the Pevensey Bridge Local History Society that are reproducing in Weird Calderdale. But it would be nice to get our hands on the real Tom Bell skull again. But I guess it's hiding lost in a vault somewhere underneath Manchester University.
Or on someone's mantelpiece. with a candle stuck on it or something.
Yeah, paperweight.
Some hippie in Hebden Bridge has got it. So after the debate and after everything had settled down a bit, there was a little bit of a tragic end for Abraham Foster Barrett. What happened to him?
So, yes, Abraham Foster Barrett, who led the cavists, came to a very tragic end a couple of years later in 1902. Barrett believed that he'd had a message from God telling him to stop eating, to stop drinking, and to stop sleeping. He began having hallucinations. He became violent. His mother said that he'd gone for 16 days without sleep. And he was eventually confined to Clayton Workhouse, and he became out of control, smashing everything he could get his hands on and attacking everyone. And then he died the following day. So we've got this awful death where he's plagued by insanity, hallucinations, and starvation that sort of mirrors in a strange way Willie the Woodcutter's death in the Dearden poem.
Was there any kind of conclusion as to what had happened to him, medical conclusion?
Well, the verdict of the doctor was that he died of acute mania and cerebral apoplexy.
Right. It sounds quite nasty.
It does sound grim, yeah.
Oh, so poor old Abraham Foster Barrett. But the story still didn't go away, did it?
No, I mean, throughout the early 20th century, there are a number of attempts to explore the cave and to find Tom Bell's treasure. I mean, John Clay, the leading anti-cavist in 1900, had another attempt. He found, again, no evidence of humans having lived there. He claimed to have found Herbert Cooper's hook, the one that he'd used to drag out Tom Bell's skull. And he described the cave as being about 20 yards long with a number of intricate passages leading off it. Another expedition in 1900 as well was by Sam Fielding, and he led a party that entered the cave from two different entrances. He got involved in a number of local controversies, especially over dowsers, which he had a thing against, which you can read about in Weird Calderdale. And let me give a quote from Sam Fielding's exploration of the cave that he gave to the local papers. So he described his visit to the cave in 1900, and he said the entrance near the crags was searched in all its bendings, the party sometimes creeping and worming themselves along narrow passages and then coming upon open chambers where several could stand erect. And that's one of the things that we get with these explorations of the cave, in that there seems to be some very narrow worm-like passage that you have to crawl through, and it's only just wide enough for one person to crawl through on their belly, and then it opens out into a kind of a cavern or a chamber. So that seems to be a common theme in the cave. He described this bit as a needle's eye ordeal, and only one party of the people who explored the cave was brave enough to try it, but that led to different chambers in there. And they claimed that they'd found a link between the two entrances of the cave. Again, what we've got here is it's not clear which entrance they're talking about. The entrance near the crags, well, that there are a number of possible entrances. So again, we're left with a bit of confusion over which cave they're talking about.
You wouldn't get me down crawling around in tiny spaces for love nor money, really. But there's always one person in the party who's prepared to do it, isn't there? In 1958, there was another attempt by two unnamed Halifax youths.
This is an interesting one, and I don't know how much to believe it, but these two youths, according to the Halifax Courier in 1958, went deeper and deeper into the cave, walking for hours. They went so deep that there was a lack of air that meant that their candles were going out and they were finding it hard to breathe. They claimed that they found a 20-foot drop between two huge rock faces, and it took them hours to get back to the surface. So this sounds a little on the implausible side, given what some of the other people have described.
Yeah, there seems to be a recurring theme, doesn't it, of people finding it difficult to get out of the cave. I mean, you could look at it in just that they're kind of a little bit disorientated from being underground for so long.
Herbert Cooper, of course, claimed to have been lost for 2 hours. And
the
way that these stories are told in the newspapers, it's almost like they're telling a horror story. I mean, if you think the journalist Max Tickner described for the Halifax Evening Courier in 1967 how he'd explored the cave, and he took along with him a rope, a lamp, and a bottle of tranquilizers. That's how scared he was.
Not a good idea.
Yeah, I mean, he described four small chambers and then a steep passage. And then again, we've got the needle eye ordeal hole that he had to crawl through, which came into a large cavern. But at the moment he was in the cavern, his torch started flickering, even though the battery was new, and he found himself almost in the dark, alone, a long way underground. And then he was sure he could hear someone breathing. So whether this was the ghost of Tom Bell or, as he suspected, just his imagination, it was a terrifying experience.
He had two attempts, though, didn't he, Max?
He did. He tried some of the other entrances to the cave, the one at Hellhole Rocks in Heptonstall, and the one at Mytham. But again, he didn't get very far with those. And again, we come back to the same question. Which entrance are they talking about? It's never very clear. And again, the four small chambers, a short passage, a huge cavern, those seem to be common themes, but we're just never clear which entrance they're talking about.
Sounds pretty typical for caves, doesn't it, wherever you go?
It does. It does.
If we move forward quite significantly now, almost, well, pretty close to the present day, really, and we've got an expedition in 2015 by Mark Simmons and friends.
That's right, and at least nowadays it can be filmed and put on the internet, and you can find this on YouTube quite easily. So 2015, Mark Simmons went into Tom Bell's cave, and you can see on the video there's like a hole in the side of the hill, and then there's a large drop, and then you're into a pretty small cavern. And it looks like parts of the cavern have entrances that are blocked up. And there have been rumours that the cave entrance had been blocked up. So,
is this the one in Hardcastle Crags?
This is Hardcastle Crags, yeah, the main Tom Bell cave. And there was a bit of excitement in the video when they saw something that looked like gold, but it turned out to be water droplets reflecting sunlight on the lichen. All they found was an empty pop can, a mushroom, a spider, and they said it's a bit whiffy, it smells of pee.
That's disappointing, isn't it?
It is, but interestingly, one of the comments on the YouTube video says they've been exploring the wrong cave, so we're back to which is the real Tom Bell's cave. So, I mean, if you look on the website of Hebden Hay Youth Hostel, where there's a short article about Tom Bell and the cave, they say there that the entrance known as Tom Bell's Cave now isn't the original entrance to Tom Bell's Cave, which has been walled up, supposedly because a child was nearly lost in it. So, again, the whole thing seems very confusing.
So you say, to quote you from your book, the story of Tom Bell leads inevitably to the question of whether there is any historical truth to the legend. So I was wondering if we can just discuss the concluding evidence, just to summarize. So if we start with the skull.
So, well, the skull was real, but was it Tom Bell's skull? seems unlikely given the age of it.
Yeah.
We're not quite sure when the legendary Tom Bell was supposed to have lived. In the newspaper articles in the 20th century, some of them say he lived in the 8th century. Some of them say he lived in the late 19th century, which makes no sense as the poems that, that refer to him were written in the 1840s. So we've got no real clue as to when the story is supposed to be set.
If we go back to William Broadbent's poem, and you mentioned as well at the top of the episode, he says, how long he'd lived or where he died, lo, nothing more is said besides. So he doesn't date him at all, does he? So we've got the skull, could be Neolithic. We don't really know a date. But strangely, there is a plausible candidate, isn't there? There's a story about somebody who could fit in with the legend. Who's he?
Yeah, there is a plausible candidate for the origin of the legend that possibly led to the legend and that led to the poems that led to the story as we know it today. And that's a character called Joseph Bailey. And this seems to me to sort of provide the link from how we get from the Willie the Woodcutter death in the Dearden poem to the exploding death of Tom Bell the Glutton in the modern versions of the legend. And this was discovered by a local historian called J.A. Higginbottom and published in the Transactions of the Halifax Antiquarian Society in 1989. And he found that in 1779, a man was walking his dog on Scout Rocks above Mythemroyd, and his dog ran into this narrow cave. So the man followed his dog, and it went through a narrow passage into a large chamber. And inside the chamber, they found what they described as a savage, an armed man hiding out in the cave, armed with a pistol. So anyway, the man and his dog fled, and they brought help. And they captured this savage troglodyte. And they found that the cave was full of stolen goods from local farmhouses and churches as far away as Rochdale. And also that the cave was full of cured meat. So we've got this idea of someone hiding out in his cave and gorging himself on meat that he'd stolen. So Joseph Bailey was transported after that. But we've got all these elements here that seem to fit the story. We've got, you know, the savage troglodyte armed, hiding out in his cave with his treasure and his store of meat. And we've got the surprise discovery and everything. We've got the thief, you know, and even the name Bailey and Bell have a very similar ring to it. And it could be that people's memory of this exciting episode became over the years mutated and transmogrified into the story of Tom Bell, the glutton hiding in his cave. And then we get mixed up with the poems and the strange death of Willie the Woodcutter, and it all sort of mixed together into the strange stew that we were talking about earlier.
It's a really interesting story, whether it's based on any kind of real person or not. I was really unaware of the fact that we have so many caves in and around the Hebden Bridge area, but you've grown up around here, so maybe you've got more an inside knowledge.
Yeah, possibly. Although exploring caves, it's not something I'd be particularly keen on doing as well.
No, I was going to ask you if you'd had a go.
I asked some of the people working in Hebden Hay Hostel to show me where the entrance to Tom Bell's cave was, and they showed me one entrance. It looked to be like the same one that Mark Simmons went in. You can see a little opening, but then you've got to crawl through, and then there seems to be a drop, and probably you need some specialist equipment, really, to get in there.
Yeah.
Some of the older explorations that we read about in the early 20th century, it seems like they walked in there, and you know, with candles. So it's very hard to put your finger on which cave to explore, if that's what you wanted to do.
So is there a general consensus of which are the main caves that are involved in the whole story and all the expeditions? So you've got the main one at Hardcastle Crags. You mentioned Hell Hole Rocks. So is there a cave up there?
Supposedly somewhere behind Hell Hole Rocks. And Max Tickner described it in 1967, but he couldn't get very far. It looked like there'd been a rock fall or something. And so it was blocked. I mean, supposedly from the entrance in Hardcastle Crags, you could hear people poking their fires in Hepton's stall.
Really?
Through the labyrinthine connections of the cave.
Mm. And then you've also mentioned that there was possibly an entrance at Mytham down by the church.
Mm. Somewhere near the church. And again, it's not very clear where that is. So Max Ticknor doesn't give us any real clue apart from saying it's somewhere near the church. So, I mean, there could be lots of entrances. To confuse matters even more, during the great debate about Tom Bell's skull in January 1900, the chair of the debate said that he'd heard that Tom Bell's cave was a name given to a number of different caves throughout the valley. I haven't heard that anywhere else, but if that's true, that does confuse it. And it's quite plausible because Joseph Bailey, that one of the origins of Tom Bell, his cave was near Scout Rocks in Mythemroyd. So it's quite possible that the legend of Tom Bell has in the past been associated with a number of different caves, and maybe it was just Hardcastle Crags and its tourist industry that ended up being the focal point for the legend.
There's a stone head, isn't there, at Hardcastle Crags?
Yes, on the wall of Hebdenay Hostel, you'll see a stone head that's supposed to be that of Tom Bell, and it's said that its gaze is pointing towards the cave. So that's one way to find the cave, is to follow the eye line of the stone head.
Right. How long has that been there?
Well, it was actually part of the cafe. It used to be on the cafe that was there up until the early 20th century. And when that was demolished, the stone head was taken off and put on the new building. It's supposed to be in approximately the right position. But here again, we've got another bit that makes finding the cave more difficult, because it says approximately the same position. So if it's been moved a little bit, that's going to change the direction of its gaze. So
yeah,
Tom Bell remains ever elusive.
And supposedly any treasure that's down there.
Yeah, that's right. And a lot of descriptions of the cave seem to have a large drop near the entrance. So that sort of makes it hard for your casual explorer to get in there. And that's always going to confuse the matter.
We should probably say that we don't really advocate people go in with ropes and candles on a summer's evening.
It's probably not a good idea. And, you know, remembering the tales of people being lost for hours and hearing heavy breathing in the cave, that might be enough to scare people off. And supposedly the original cave has been blocked off, and the entrance that's called Tom Bell's Cave now isn't the original. And that seems plausible, but again, I can't find any record of someone being properly lost in the cave or of it being blocked up. I don't know whether that is actually part of the legend as well.
Yeah. Thank you so much for coming on the podcast again, Paul.
My pleasure.
You've been listening to History Out Loud, a podcast by Calderdale Libraries. Produced and presented by Jill Carpenter. And next time, History Out Loud regular Sarah Browning will be back to discuss the great Todmorden versus Hebden Bridge brass band controversy of 1898.